Hello, everybody, and welcome again to F This Movie, the podcast that's hip to be square. My name is Patrick Bromley. I'm joined tonight for Scary Movie Month by Doug.
Thank you.
You Patrick don't sound Bromley nearly scary enough.
Patrick Bateman.
Bromley. Oh, Bateman, yeah.
Boo Bateman.
You went with something much more appropriate.
Boo Burns.
When I say, like, I'm joined tonight by Doug, you gotta sound scarier.
Oh. Hello and welcome to F This Movie.
I'm joined tonight by the ghost of Doug.
By Dracula.
Dracula yes. Doug. hi, you're listening to F This Movie. It's Scary Movie Month, which we love. And I got to get all this, you know, nonsense out of the way that I do at the start of every show. Like the fact that you can find our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com. It's so scary.
What's the ETA on transitioning that from Blogspot to some other site?
What does ETA mean?
It means everything's awesome.
Oh! Then now.
Everything's everything awesome is awesome now. Right now. And everything is two words. I don't know if you know that.
fthismovie.blogspot.com. We got Scary Movie Month going on right now. Lots of scary columns and a fun game that we'll get to in a second that is in full swing. You can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Become our fan on Facebook, facebook.com/fthismovie.
Actually, they changed it. It's no longer a fan. You now have to like
us on Facebook.
On Facebook, yeah. Because Mark Zuckerberg is a ghoul, and you have to punch him in the face.
And twitter.com/fthismovie. Lots of Scary Movie Month hashtags going on there.
Yeah, if you hashtag scary, if you write something on Twitter and hashtag it Scary Movie Month, all one word, even if you're not following us on Twitter, I will find you,
yeah,
and I will retweet it.
But you should follow us on Twitter, right?
And if it sounds like I'm coming on to you, I am. Right now. Hard. But yeah, you should absolutely follow us on Twitter. Even if you're like, here's the thing. Even if you're like, well, I don't have a Twitter account. Or I do, but I haven't touched it since 2009. Fucking log on to it. Find your handle. Find your password, because it's probably something stupid, because it's like 3 years old.
Right.
And follow
us. It's your leftover Friendster handle.
Absolutely. And then log off, and forget about it. Because we're all about quantity over quality. We need the numbers in order to get that sweet, sweet Twitter pie.
Do you want to do the Scary Movie Challenge first, or do you want to do Have You Seen Anything Scary Lately first?
Whatever.
I'm pulling back the curtain. I'm letting the audience be part of the process.
This is interesting. We should have talked about this before, and I could have written it out longhand on a piece of notebook paper.
I like it. I like transparency.
You like, things on the fly.
That's right.
You also like The Fly.
Kind of.
Which one do you like?
The Fly 2 with Eric Stoltz. And, of course, Zuniga.
Do you like the original Fly from 58, like JB talked about in his write-up yesterday?
I like it just fine, but I think the remake is a much better movie.
With Jeff Goldblum?
Yes, same with The Blob. And
or
The Thing.
Or Goldberg, the wrestler. Was he in that, too?
Bill Goldberg? No. three horror science fiction movies in the 50s with superior 80s remakes.
I just
named them all.
Like the remake of The Fly with Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Nice. He's very talented.
We could do either one. If you want to pull up the list of the
all right, let's do the Scary Movie Challenge. So if you're listening and you don't already know this, you're crazy, because it's Scary Movie Month and we do this thing called the Scary Movie Challenge. Last year, we set a goal of 100 movies, and we got to 125.
Very impressive, because it was impressive because it was a new site.
Right.
It only had, we'd only been around for a few months.
Yeah.
I think we started in May, right? May of 2010.
That sounds right. Yeah.
And it was October. So for having 100 reviews, that's impressive. Yeah. We've been around for a while. We have no excuses now. We're like the veterans. We're the old grizzled balls of the movie blog industry.
This year, we set the goal of 150, and we're already like in the 130s. So we're pretty sure we're going to beat it. My goal now is to get to like 300, which is a huge leap. That's double our original estimate.
I have to time out right there. 300 is not a scary movie.
No.
It is a sexy movie.
Yeah, kind of.
Well, and a violent movie.
Which is scary. I think violence is scary, but I also think sex is scary.
I think violence is sexy. Is that weird? I'm a cutter.
So the deal is, if you go to fthismovie.blogspot.com and find the F This Movie, F Scary Movies Challenge Part 2.
It's very wordy, by the way.
It is.
I understand why you did it
that I've been
way.
Linking to it in most other blog posts. So if you just, usually you could find like the top one or two blog posts.
And I'm all
and
about branding. You definitely, like it's the F This Movie, F Scary.
Yeah.
It's like McDonald's presents
I know
the Monopoly
what I did. Exactly.
contest.
Right.
Which, by the
Mug
way,
Mug Root Beer presents the Dana Carvey Show.
That's right.
That's what I was going for.
Oh, man, I can go for some Mug Root Beer right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Wes Craven presents Dracula 2000. So if you go to the F This Movie, F Scary Movies Challenge 2, every time you watch a horror movie in the month of October, write a 7-word review and post it on the Scary Movie Challenge. And then every so often on the show, we like to read some of the ones that stand out.
Do you plan to do Roman numerals? Like, let's say this podcast exists for years.
Yeah.
20 years, 30 years. Are you going to be like the Super Bowl and have very confusing Roman numerals?
You think I should go?
No, I'm just asking. I don't know. I don't have an original thought. That's why I'm along for the ride.
I'm with Roman numeral 2.
That's why you call me Doug Coattails. last name here. Keep my anonymity, although it's pretty obvious who I am.
So let's read some of the some of the ones we like Grayson, who wrote Troll 2. The moral is never trust a vegetarian. Words to live by.
Absolutely.
Or what about
Lori? Lori is after my heart. I think there's one. Okay, let me tell you a little quick story about Lori. She's on Twitter. I find her because I'm like a stalker, and I'm on Twitter as at this movie, and she hashtags Scary Movie Month, and I'm like, hey, Lori, I think I have something that you would love. This sounds totally up your alley. We've got a website, and there's a little challenge. You watch a scary movie, and you write a 7-word review.
I just explained all of this.
Did you?
Not to Lori. I was explaining it to you and our listeners. Do you think Lori is listening?
I hope so. Lori, listen. Forget about Patrick right now. This is between you and Doug, who is me. Listen, we are very grateful and thankful. You actually retweeted us our stuff too, so that's great. And
That's awesome.
Then you went on our site and logged in, which is, you know, it's kind of a hassle sometimes if you're the hustle and bustle of the world.
Yeah.
And you wrote 2 reviews. I'm going to read them both right now.
OMG.
Back to back, because Lori and me, we got a thing. She wrote Fright Night. Surprisingly not as good as the remake.
Listen, Lori, here's where I need to step in. I know that this was just between you and Doug for a minute, but I need to step in.
Talk about a third
wheel. You're crazy, Lori. The original is so much better.
So I'm gathering, and I'm not a scientician, but I'm gathering she likes the remake more than the original.
That's what I gather, too, and I appreciate everything she's done for us, but her and I part ways here.
Interesting. Yeah. Lori, you're making me choose right now between my best friend Patrick and you, my new love, my new flame. All right, let's see what she has to say about What Lies Beneath. This could seal the deal. If we stay together like two pancakes, or if I stick with you for the past 30 years we've been together like two pancakes... Okay, Lori said, What Lies Beneath. Already off to not the best start. Because What Lies Beneath, is that Robert Zemeckis?
It is, yeah.
I have never seen it, actually. Have you?
It's the movie he made on break from Castaway. I have seen it, yeah.
Okay, she writes...
Spoilers for What Lies Beneath coming up.
Wait, should I not read this? I already did.
It's too late.
And I haven't seen it. I've ruined it for myself. Cheating husband killed by girl he murdered.
Whoa.
That sounds very confusing.
Something Lies Beneath.
What's interesting is that review is confusing, and my feelings right now are confused, because I want to pine for Lori. I think she's in Madison also, which is not too far from Chicago. I could drive up there. You don't have to tell my wife about it. I can come visit. There's a beautiful movie palace up there. It's very liberal. We all like that here at F This Movie.
We love Madison. Nails and Riffs says, Last House on the Left remake. Remakes are pointless, but Aaron Paul rocks. I agree about the remakes being pointless. I agree about the Aaron Paul. And Nails and Riffs, I have to give a shout out because I actually clicked through to the Nails and Riffs blog. Everybody should click on the Nails and Riffs blog because she just has all these different fingernail designs that are incredible.
It is fascinating. And here's the thing. I think that she might also be a person who was on Twitter first and then came to the site and had posted something. And we appreciate that. And whatever little pre-show prep we do was done literally seconds before the show. And Patrick went to the Nails and Riffs blog. I don't know if it's a word. Give the site out. I say give it out.
I think it's a blog spot like we are.
It has to be, yeah. She's got a blog spot.
It's nailsandriffs.com.
Oh, wow. She went right for the .com. Yeah, paying. It's premium grade stuff here. It is fascinating. It's a subculture I know nothing about. I respect it. She finds media. She Breaking Bad. She's a Brewers fan, and she paints her nails to look like those things. And while I think it's a little weird, because I'm a guy and I don't know anything about fingernail art, I think it's unassailably cool at the same time. So, good for you. Carl Wonders writes, Poltergeist. Poltergeist is a movie that's very near and dear to my heart.
Yeah.
A Toby Hooper movie that doesn't suck.
Once again, Carl Wonders, I dig you. You're a fan of the show, but I have to take issue because if you listen to our Poltergeist podcast from last Scary Movie Month, last year, you can find it at fthismovie.blogspot.com or in the iTunes store. We did a whole podcast on Poltergeist where I think I decided it was like my third or fourth favorite Tobey Hooper movie. So.
By the way, can I tell you that for a split second, some panic overtook me as I was reading that because I was thinking, I'm going to say it Tobe because it's written out and I know it's Tobey Hooper. I'm not an idiot, but I see it as Tobe and I almost said it because this is the show where all of our wounds are exposed. Yeah. All of our pimples are.
Joseph Finn says the others, curtains, sunlight, shaking tables, sad, sad ending.
You know, Joe Finn is actually, I'm sorry, I don't know if he's Joe.
Yeah, are we that?
I don't know if we're that close.
Joseph I don't know Finn if we're is also someone kind of who's, a basis.
He's very active on Twitter, and Joseph Finn, you are very popular, you have a lot of followers, and we appreciate you posting on our site. Thank you. Gray Weirdo said, son of Frankenstein. Wait, is this Caligari? Nope, it's Frankenstein.
Luke says, Jason X, is Jason really qualified for space exploration?
I don't know if he went to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory or a space camp. Isn't there a movie called Space Camp?
There is a movie called Space Camp.
If Jason went to space camp, I would say maybe he's qualified, but I don't have the facts in front of me.
It depends on what his marks are right, in space camp. Marks. Okay.
I'm going to have to shift my... If you hear some squeaking, I'm shifting my seat. Greg Talbot said, The Ring, please be kind, rewind... Asian zombie girl, as if said by Asian zombie. I should have said, quote, please be kind, rewind.
You should have done a lot of things.
I know, I messed
you
up.
You should have done this a lot of things.
So far off the rails, and I apologize.
Two more. Cameron, whose last name I hesitate to pronounce.
I'm gonna go for it.
Please do.
Cameron Cloutier.
Very nice.
Is that sound, it sounds French. It could be Cloutier.
Who is another big supporter of us on Facebook and on Twitter, and we appreciate it, Cameron.
Monsieur Cloutier.
Very nice. Says Paranormal Activity. No girlfriends passed before you move in.
That's a homonym. No, like not no girlfriends. It's like as in you should know
you
about.
You should know, yeah. About, know her past
right,
before
K-N-O-W,
you move in.
Right.
And lastly...
Brian Alford said, Demon Knight, Billy Zane deserved an Oscar.
Nice.
Interesting, he used the title in the review as part of the seven words, and that's okay, that you can do that. Demon Knight's a great movie, it's a lot of fun. Everyone should see it.
What's your favorite quote from Demon Knight?
Get that pussy off the table.
Mine is, if it makes you feel good, do it.
Both awesome quotes from Demon Knight.
Everyone, see Demon Knight as part of Scary Movie.
By the way, I have to be honest. I'm a big fan of movies, and I, like, off the top of my head,
yeah.
I'm sure if I really think about it, two Billy Zane movies, Titanic and Demon Knight.
Dead Calm.
And the Phantom? The Phantom, yeah, that's the one that I was
in Tombstone.
Of. But I know, this is like, you've made a name for yourself as the person with villain stamped on their forehead in Titanic, and as... The Demon Slayer and Demon Knight?
He's the demon. He's not the slayer.
Interesting.
He's the demon.
Mine eyes are open.
William Sadler is the Demon Knight. K-N-I-G-T.
Nice.
What now? So thank you very much. You guys keep posting to the F-Scary Movies Challenge 2 so we get to 300 by Halloween. Douglas.
Yes.
Have you seen anything scary lately?
I've seen a couple things. I did one review in the thing I saw.
Can you do some more, please?
I will.
It's October.
I know. I'm dropping the ball. I saw a movie called Devil.
Yes. Presented by M. Night Shyamalan.
Oh my God. It should be called Delevator. Wait, Devilator. Delevator?
Delevator.
Delevator.
Right, yeah.
Devilator.
Elevator to hell.
Don't be an Ella hater.
Nice.
About Devil. It's fine. I have nothing too much to say. I really am like, I saw it.
I remember very little of it. It had a good trailer.
It's such a dumb movie. It's the devil. These five strangers are on a elevator, yeah. And the elevator gets stuck. They're in Philadelphia, and they all have like a sordid past, and one of them is the devil. And if you think about it, it could be interesting. In that it could be small and interesting and good if it was small, but it tries to be so big.
Yeah.
And it's just,
definitely.
It comes out.
And it's fairly obvious, I think.
Yeah.
Like who the devil is.
And even if, but it's just so dumb by that time the reveal comes.
Sure,
like,
sure,
who
sure.
Fucking cares, right, right, you know? Right. It's just, I don't know.
I wanted that one guy who's married to Christina Hendricks to be the devil. And maybe he is, everyone. I'm not going
to
spoil
that. I wanted Helen Hunt to stop taking the potion that makes her look like a 20-something because the girl in that movie looks like a young Helen Hunt. Very thin lips, very angular face,
you know who
water
I did,
dancing the entire time.
You know who I did like in that movie, though, was... Chris Messina, the guy who plays the cop.
Yeah.
I thought he was good and like gave a performance like did police work.
Right.
Which cops in movies so rarely do.
He was actually believable in as much as he wasn't like overacting and everything right. Wasn't a dumb cliche. And even the stuff that was cliche-y, he said with some level of believability.
It's kind of a thankless role because it's just like, I'm going to get you guys out of that elevator.
I have a question for all the F-heads out there who listen to F this movie, hence the term F-head. the movie Buried.
Yeah.
It's about a guy in a tomb, a crypt, if you will. He's buried in a grave. is it a horror movie?
No.
Patrick says no. I say, why not? I can't even argue that yes, it is, because obviously it's Ryan, what's his name?
Ryan Reynolds. The Green Lantern. Why didn't he just, like, make a Hot Wheels slide?
That's right. And get out of the tomb, out of the grave. it takes place in Iraq, and he's a contractor working for the military, and he gets buried by some insurgents. And I saw it, and it should just be called, like, torture porn, you're fucked. It's such a depressing movie, but it's not horror. And I was pissed about halfway through, because we had this conversation before. You hadn't seen it.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen it. I'm like, I think it's a horror movie. And you're like, oh, I don't think so. And I'm like, well, I'm going to watch it and find out.
Yeah.
And halfway through, I realized, this isn't a horror movie. And I wasted, and it's not very long, but I wasted an hour and 20-some minutes of my life waiting
for it. But you did watch another horror movie.
I did?
On your birthday. Happy birthday, Doug.
Thank you.
On Netflix Instant, you watched
the sequel. I watched Return to Sleepaway Camp.
Yeah, you did.
By Robert Hilsick.
If you guys haven't already listened to our Sleepaway Camp commentary,
you should.
You should. It's how we kicked off Scary Movie Month.
Would you say with an H and L? I know you're, or Hertz. What's his name? Hilsick.
Hilsick.
But it's H L I.
No, it's.
Isn't it?
No.
H-I-L-T?
H-I-L.
Okay, yeah. I thought it was H-L. I was like, Hlitzik, Hlitzik. Like Favre, Brett Favre. I did see it. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely absurd. It's very bright. The movie is very,
it is very bright.
Like,
it is.
The main character, who I assume we're supposed to feel some empathy or sympathy for, is despicable.
Know.
He's the worst in invention.
He has stains on his shirt.
He is a cartoon character, and I would punch him if I was in the same situation, too. It's a insane movie.
It takes so much of what we loved about Sleepaway Camp and cranks it up.
It's on crystal meth, for sure.
It is.
And with a megaphone and like a toddler in the background drumming on drums. That's the kind of movie it is. It's just loud and obnoxious and not as fun as Sleepaway Camp, honestly. I think Sleepaway Camp is so earnest and so genuine, and I think that there are definite moments of earnestness and genuineness in this movie also, but I do think he is in on some of the joke, and I think in the first one he had no idea it would become what it became.
Well, I think just by virtue of the fact that, like, it's a sequel and the first sort of true sequel to the original Sleepaway Camp, he knows that he's making it for an audience of fans, whereas he didn't know that about the first movie. So maybe that's what it is more than anything, because I still don't think it's
self-aware.
I don't think it's funny on purpose.
I think the first one, though, obviously, too, he made this, like, summer camp movie in the early 80s at a time when that was in vogue, and it was all movies, not all, but a lot of movies like Friday the 13th came out and were like that also, and he was just another entry in that world. Now, it's standalone. There's no movies about camp. I can't.
Right.
The last one is What Happened to America.
There's no such thing as a camp anymore.
Right. And so it's this camp. And even that is like, okay, am I supposed to buy into that there's a camp? But there's kids who are 12 and there's adults. Like, why are these 19-year-old urban city kids, like all of them, you know, at camp?
Yeah.
And I don't know. And there's no nudity, too. It's R. It should have some boobs.
There's not nudity in the original Sleepaway Camp.
There's some dick.
unless you count full frontal male
there's
nudity.
There's definitely some
My voice went up because there's a question.
And there's some balls.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I saw that. I also saw...
But that's available on Netflix Instant. Everybody should watch it.
I also saw some of Paranormal Activity 2.
Oh, I have not seen that.
I saw it. It's out again. I mean, it's on Epix 2 or something like that. And
I don't have Dish.
I should see the whole thing. I didn't see the whole thing. I fell asleep.
Yeah.
Which I guess is a testament to that it didn't really scare me that much.
Do you think in Paranormal Activity 3, the ghost is going to create a fake Facebook account?
Is that something that happened, or what's the...
It's the guys that made Catfish.
Oh, yeah. that's a deep cut.
Well, listen...
It's Ariel Schulman.
Yeah.
Is that the guy who made Catfish?
Neve something? I don't know. Neve was like the star. He wasn't.
I think he's part of it too. Yeah.
Does he play the ghost?
I saw the preview for Paranormal Activity 3, and actually, it's effective because it always is effective. It's like people in a bathroom doing Bloody Mary or something, and then.
But again, I haven't seen the movies, but it seems like rather than
you haven't seen the first one?
I saw the first one. Oh, I haven't seen the sequels, and it seems like rather than just do the same thing over and over again, which they're still sort of doing, just haunted house movies. They are like trying to create a mythology and like a backstory and like tie all these things together. I just assumed, like, when the second one came out, I just assumed like it's another house that's haunted.
Right.
But it's like tied into the first movie, and so is this one.
And that's even like the first one ends in such a way that like there's a picture in the, I forget it, it was years ago I saw it, but it doesn't.
Jack Nicholson is in the painting and you're like, he's been there all along.
The first one ends and there's a picture in an attic and this girl has a past and there's like spirits haunt her. And she's the one who's kind of possessed.
Right.
Spoilers for Paranormal Activity. And the second one, what I've gathered, she's a part of it, but it's at a different house. And there's like, it's just.
Yeah, I don't know.
And if there is a mythology, I guess, you know, if Book of Shadows taught us anything.
I guess that's fine. But like, because again, that was one of the things I liked about the Saw movies, because they got so crazy with mythology that was the interesting part.
Right.
But to see Paranormal Activity go down the same road, I don't know.
It was interesting. One of the reviews on the F This Movie, F Scary Movie Challenges 2 said Paranormal Activity, and it was the review, and I'm paraphrasing, was the most boring time I've had in the theater or something, or like really boring. And actually, I kind of disagree. I actually think the movie works on a lot of different levels. I ultimately think it doesn't, it's not an excellent, excellent scary movie. It's not like one of the best things I've ever seen, but it definitely did create an atmosphere and a feeling in me that was just very interesting and different, and I was kind of freaked out at certain
I still like the first movie.
Yeah, the first one,
and I don't
think
get
works.
Scared easily, but the first one I was kind of like,
yeah, definitely is like, because it's, I mean, again, it's set up in such a way that like it's in a suburban house, it's new, it's like young people with a, you know, they don't have a kid in the first one, there's kids in the second one, and it's just definitely more relatable than, you know, something more far fetched,
and like it was like fun. Scary, like
parts of it were, but parts of it were scary, scary.
Well, but I mean, even that, it was still like fun. It's not like like a Rob Zombie movie,
right?
Which is like, this is scary because it's oppressive in how horrible it makes me feel,
right?
It's like fun, scary.
This is fun, like when there's a noise downstairs, and there's like the camera has such a limited scope of the flashlight on the camera, and it's like tunnel vision.
It's fun, like when Aunt Zelda sits up on the bed.
Oh, definitely fun.
And then runs towards. Originally,
You're talking about Pet Sematary, the scariest movie you've ever seen.
On fthismovie.blogspot.com, we posted something. Our favorite moments in horror movies, and I wrote about Aunt Zelda, and I originally included a video link. The problem was, it was all the Aunt Zelda moments cut together. Somebody did it, but for some reason,
someone did that.
Yeah, but for some reason, they added this effect where it's like all sepia toned and like grainy, so it looks like an old movie. You know?
Oh,
like,
no, they made it better,
right? It's so much scarier now that it looks like this weird found old film stock.
Now that it looks like a picture I took at Great America at Six Flags in my Old West saloon.
I ended up deleting the video, but it's available on YouTube if you've never seen it. It's around the 3-minute mark when she runs towards the camera, and it's the worst thing you'll
ever see. It is definitely frightening. Absolutely.
Yeah. I have watched a bunch of scary movies lately. I've been on a tear because it's Scary Movie Month, to the point where I've actually forgotten a lot of what I've watched because it's a lot of stuff on Netflix, and most of it has been bad, but IFC every night has been running horror movies.
IFC is the best and the worst.
Yeah, well, they have commercials.
Yeah.
But at least now they're finally showing stuff in the correct aspect ratio.
Okay.
Because for a while they weren't. It wasn't like anamorphic, basically.
The IFC, again, for me, I almost skip past it because it's not high def on Dish. Mm. I know it's high def on Comcast.
Yeah.
Man, I would love to watch. But man, the commercials too are so intrusive, especially near the end.
There's a bunch. So I watched The Dark Half, the George Romero, Stephen King adaptation from 1993, which I saw the night it came out and have not seen since and did not remember 2 seconds of. It's great for like the first hour, partially because it's just like set on the East Coast and it takes place in fall and it's exactly the sort of vibe you want at this time of year.
Right.
And then it starts to...
We all wish we lived in Maine.
We do. Fictional towns in Maine. And Timothy Hutton is actually good in it. He doesn't get the leading role that often, but it falls apart in the second hour. And I've watched a couple other Stephen King adaptations lately, and I've come to this idea that like the reason that they all fall apart is because in the second hour, there always has to be an explanation for the supernatural thing, and his explanations are always disappointing. In a book, you can kind of get away with it because you're just talking about these ideas, and so it's like, I may not buy it, but okay, I'll run with it. I'm thinking of like Under the Dome, I don't know if you guys have read Under the Dome, listeners. It's not so much a horror novel, but there's a definite explanation at the end of that book. And it's like, ah, this isn't great, but okay, because you're talking about ideas. As soon as you get into movies, when you have to like really visualize things and explain it in a short amount of time, it always disappoints.
See, this
always.
Is why I don't have this problem. I only stick to Stephen King movie adaptations that Stephen King himself directs. So I've only seen the Shining made-for-TV movie.
He didn't direct that.
He didn't?
He wrote the screenplay, but Mick Garris directed that.
I thought I thought the whole thing was like he was so pissed at Kubrick for the first...
He wrote a new screenplay, but he did not direct it. It was Mick Garris, who directs a lot of Stephen King stuff.
I thought
stuff.
It was definitely him, because that thing...
The only thing he's ever directed is Maximum Overdrive.
I don't know if I've even seen that.
It's one of the worst horror movies ever made.
And let me tell you something about the Shining made-for-TV thing. I don't know if we've mentioned this before on the podcast. I saw that the 2 days, it was a two-parter, 2 days it came out. Is it 4 hours long? Is that why it's...
That sounds right.
Or under because of commercials, but still, it's a long, it's a, you know, a job to watch it. And I remember watching with my mom, or my dad, he probably was sleeping behind us. The first half was, I thought was like good. Yeah. My sensibilities, of course, I was a young kid, but... And then I was excited about the second half, and it just so goes off. The first half, again, it's all building and not showing.
And
that's
the same with It. I don't know. Did you watch It?
I didn't know. Great first hour. I didn't want to watch it. I kind of made a choice to not because I was like clowns and, you know.
Great first hour, scary clown.
Right.
Bad second hour.
Okay.
And then the other thing I'll talk about is a movie called Captivity from a couple years ago, directed by, I think, Roland Jaffe, who has never really directed a horror movie.
I think you mean Al Jaffe.
Alicia Cuthbert. It's the lighter side of torture porn. Alicia Cuthbert stars in it. And for people who like complain about torture porn, like when they see Saw or Hostel, I get it. But those movies try and tell a story. They try to be about something. Captivity, I remember, was real controversial at the time because it had these billboards in California that people were all bent out of shape about. I don't even remember what was on the billboards. It is one of the biggest pieces of shit I've ever seen.
Yeah, I was going to say real quick, I actually like Hostel. I full admission, I've not seen Saw. Yeah. I probably should.
See Saw?
Because I've not seen Saw.
You should see Saw.
But Hostel, I think, actually, Hostel 2 is kind of a mess, and I don't like it at all. But Hostel, the Hostel 1 is actually really, I like it a lot.
You should see Captivity.
Okay.
Because it's Alicia Cuthbert, who's like a bored model for 6 minutes, and then someone kidnaps her, and then tortures her for an hour and a half. There's no character development. There's no story being told. We don't know anything about her. Within the first 15 minutes, a different girl who's in captivity, like has her face melted off with like acid. And then she's like maybe chopped up or ground up. And then the guy who's keeping Alicia Cuthbert in captivity, like pours a bunch of body parts into a blender, including like eyes and stuff, and then blends them up and then forces Alicia Cuthbert to drink them. At one point, he shows up with her dog, like a poodle, and kills it with a shotgun. It's literally just like, what else can we do that's fucked up? And it's fascinating because I read a little bit about it, and apparently a lot of those sequences weren't in the movie originally. And some studio douchebag was like, I don't know, people seem to be into torture lately. So they went back and like shot this bullshit and added it to a movie. It's such garbage.
Was it wide released?
Yeah. It made no money. I mean, nobody went to see it and whatever, but like, yeah, thank goodness every once in a while the system works, because it is just such a hateful, violent piece of garbage.
Does it have a happy ending?
I don't want to spoil the ending of Captivity, but I guess it's happier than like the poodle being shot and the eyeball being blended.
Jesus.
Avoid it forever.
But now I kind of want to see it. Just to
I know
see.
You do, but
well,
trust
this
me.
Is our relationship. You always recommend things like, Doug, this is so horrible. You have to see it.
No one should see this. Honestly, I just described like the, really nobody ever see it. It's such garbage. it's so shitty. And it's the kind of movie that gives horror movies a bad name.
Yeah.
Because it's just awfulness for the sake of awfulness.
Jesus.
Yeah. So let's talk about the movie we're talking about tonight, half hour into the show.
A movie that is great.
Yes.
It's not awful. Everyone should see American Psycho if they haven't.
We got an email from Ben Clark, who emailed us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com.
Who the fuck is Ben Clark?
Ben writes, hi guys, remember me? Well, you should. I asked for you to F American Psycho ages ago, and you still haven't. Apparently he asked for this once before. I've been waiting patiently all this time. Well, now I'm no longer being patient, and I'm demanding you F this effing movie for F's sake. I'm just joshing with you. I listen all the time. You guys are great, but this movie would be a nice addition to the archives. The one that I would love to hear is I love this movie. By the way, I'm from Australia, and you guys should make a big deal of that because we're, like, different and a rare species, kind of like Martians. So I'm thinking, whoa, an Australian. Well, this is unbelievable. Definitely do what it says. American Psycho, let's do it. That was a great email.
Do I love Ben Clark right
Absolutely.
Now? Ben Clark is the best. I wish I had an Australian accent.
I wrote him back and explained that I'm sorry because if he had emailed us once before.
It never
arrived because the email takes a long time to get here from Australia.
It does, because they use koalas, I think, to swim across the Pacific.
But I love all things Australian, so I have to respect this man's request.
I need to hear your Australian accent.
I'm not going to do it.
No,
I'm not going to do it.
Like, oh yeah.
No. It would be disrespectful to Ben Clark.
The goddamn chosen.
Let's talk about American...
By the way, now that I know that this was a request by Ben Clark from Australia, I feel kind of bad that we just... talk for 30 minutes because the podcast
he's all like
get
to it. I know he's like wait for months.
I don't fucking care
but
about
he loved all that conversation about buried.
Good god. Now go back and cut that shit out. Sorry Ben Clark.
American Psycho,
go.
Okay. I'm gonna go way back. My first job ever was at a library.
Library. Take me to the library.
It's pronounced library. When I was like 15, I just shelved books. And I actually didn't like the job because there was no sense of accomplishment. Because you would shelve books for 4 hours and then you'd come back and they've all been replaced. All the books are back. You never had a sense of like, a good day's work.
Right.
And at the time, I was trying to, because I was working in a library and I'm shelving books and I'm looking for stuff to read and I'm trying to fancy myself sort of a more sophisticated reader at age 15 or 16.
You had
a
pipe.
So I started, I started reading some Bret Easton Ellis books. I read like...
I'm sorry?
Bret Easton Ellis.
Oh, I mean, I'm sorry.
I read like Less Than Zero and I read The Rules of Attraction, although I think that might have been a couple years later. But American Psycho was a book I was always fascinated by, but I was honestly like nervous to read it. Because I would read the reviews on the back and I just knew that like I maybe flipped through a few passages and I was just like, oh, this is so graphic and so horrible that I was always afraid to read it. So I never read it. And when they came out with a movie of it, I was like, I wonder how they did that.
Right.
Because I knew it was in development for a long time. It was sort of a very popular, very controversial book. And they tried a bunch of different times to get a movie off the ground.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by the whole story about the pre-production for the movie, like all the different, we'll get to
and all the ways
second.
It could have gone horribly wrong. God, Oliver Stone. so it's a movie that I think is, I think it's really good. I have some problems with it, but I think it's really good. And more than anything else, I think it's a kind of a miracle that like they pulled it off in such a way that like, oh, this is the only way to make this material work. And I having not read the book, I don't know how much of that can be credited.
So you haven't read it even now?
I haven't. And okay. I don't know how much of that can be credited to Bret Easton Ellis and how much of it should be credited to Mary Harron, because I don't know how much of the book is meant to be funny.
Okay.
Because the movie is very funny and very satirical.
I think I read somewhere that most of the dialogue that Patrick Bateman says is verbatim dialogue from the book.
Okay.
And most of it. I'm not sure if that's all the case. I think maybe there's some ad-libs about like the music specifically and things like that. Yeah. But I think most of what he says, even so much so that even some of the dialogue in specific scenes is from other Bret Easton Ellis novels to
Of
fit into the structure of the movie. Like there's a line, I think, when he's with Samantha Mathis where that's taken from Rules of Attraction.
Interesting.
So, but it's definitely very loyal. And I think Bret Easton Ellis actually talked about when he saw the movie... He liked it a lot, and I think he had two issues or two things he would have changed or something, I think. And the biggest thing, like no joke, was that he would have not had Patrick Bateman do a moonwalk in the scene where he kills Paul Allen. That was what he took issue with.
Yeah.
And I'm like, if that's all you're taking issue with, because it's honestly, it's kind of funny.
Yeah, right.
If that's what you take issue with. And he also didn't like the narration, which I kind of understand as an author. I think in a book it's a lot easier, as you mentioned before with Stephen King, it's words, and you can have long exposition about the reasons for things and a person and rambling, basically. In a movie, it's all show and try not to tell, and they do some narration in this. Patrick Bateman, I think the last line, and which is the last line in the book, I think, too, is this confession has meant nothing.
Right.
And I think he didn't like the narration. Which is also interesting because you fucking wrote it.
Yeah, and I actually think the narration works, again, because the movie is meant to be... It's such a specific point of view and such a specific case of the unreliable narrator.
Right.
That I think the narration is almost necessary.
I think and to your point specifically, and actually I'm glad you said that, because in a lot of ways, narration in movies is cheating. It's a shortcut to explain things. But because it's an unreliable narrator, if nothing else, it just is not more confusing, not to say confusing is good, but it definitely muddies the waters and makes it even more interesting. Like, what is that? Is that real? What am I interpreting here?
Since we didn't say it already, if you haven't seen American Psycho, I know we already spoiled one element of American Psycho, but he does kill people, so that really shouldn't be spoiled. But we're going to be spoiling stuff.
I know, we always say this, but fucking watch it already, goddamn.
Most of the time we do spoil, and usually we remember to say that we're spoiling it, but if you haven't seen it, spoilers for American Psycho in the upcoming conversation. Now, you, sir, are a fan of American Psycho, correct?
Absolutely.
Yes.
And it's funny because when I first saw it, I want to say I saw it opening night with you.
Perhaps.
And I liked it a lot.
More innocent time.
And I think, and full admission here, second time I've said that today.
Yes.
I think that I liked it in 2000. I was a college kid, and I think that I liked it for sure. But I think I liked it even more because I was that college kid.
Sure.
Meaning, like, I was the guy that, like, took film studies classes and, like, you know, I bought Stranger Than Paradise, and, you know, like, Vincent Gallo's Buffalo 66 is really, really deep, man. So I definitely saw it and liked it, but I was definitely a champion of it. And I've seen it a couple times since then, and I saw it, obviously, right before this podcast. And I'm so glad I saw it now with, you know, 11 more years of maturity and thought, because I liked it now more than I've ever liked it before. Okay. I was laughing more. I was fascinated more. The one thing that I really want to hit home in this whole podcast is Christian Bale's performance is Oscar worthy / hilarious / I mean, Oscar worthy, who fucking cares what that means, because it means nothing, but it's so well done. His delivery is great. What he puts himself, I know he's famous for changing his body and stuff for performances. And this is obviously the case here because he's cut from marble. His body is ridiculous. And then he loses it all. I don't know what came first, Machinist or this, but like...
This came before the Machinist.
And so it's all gone.
Right, but then it all comes back for the Dark Knight, and then it's all gone again for the fighter.
Which is, he's nuts. I mean, he's going to kill himself, basically. Yeah. It's not healthy, but what he does physically and what he does, I have to assume, mentally, to kind of wrap his mind around the material... I even read somewhere that he spoke his American accent, like, off the set, too. He never lost it, which I know is kind of, you rolled your eyes, it's kind of douchey, but it definitely speaks to his, you know, craft, and it shows in the performance, unlike a lot of people that would do that and just give a shitty performance no matter what.
But isn't he the same guy that, like, when The Fighter came out, there's a magazine where he's like, do you want to talk to me or do you want to talk to Dickie? And, like, we could just go on for hours about how douchey that is.
Absolutely. You know what? I take back everything I said. That is a completely valid point. But if nothing else, his American accent is spot on.
Yeah.
It's such a...
Well, it's like, it's almost a cartoon of an American accent.
Right. Which is a choice.
Yeah, oh, definitely. And that's the thing. It's like, the performance is sort of one note, you know, which is why I don't think it would ever win an Oscar. But, I mean, it's a great note. And it's one of those things where, like...
I don't know if it is... Okay, I'm sorry.
I mean, it kind of is. I don't know. It's one of those things where it's like, it's so cool to watch. And I was trying to think of other examples of a similar performance, and I am not coming up with any right off the top of my head. Like, this is going to sound so weird, but like, George Clooney in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou comes to mind, where it's like, you go see it and it's not what you expect. And it's an actor making a very big choice that, like, this could go so badly.
Right.
And it's like walking a tightrope the whole time. And you're like, when it ends, you're just like, holy shit, he pulled that off. Because it's like there are Tom Hanks many...
in The Lady Killers.
Waffles. We must have waffles forthwith. To watch him sort of pull that whole thing off is unbelievable. And I have very little patience for Christian Bale, especially at this point, because he just had a lot of growly, shouty performances. I thought he was really good in The Fighter. He's fine as Batman. Like, whatever. I know he's a talented guy, but I kind of have no patience for him. But... I will always appreciate him, if nothing else, even if one day I'm like, I hate Christian Bale, I will always have a soft spot for him because of American Psycho. I think he's so great in American Psycho.
Well, that's the thing. You have to almost separate the fact, you know, all like lately, obviously, it's Dickie. And his performance in The Fighter is great.
Yeah.
But again, the context, the bookends is that he's a douchebag and whatever else. And of course, the Terminator Salvation.
That was really the tipping point for me. Issue. Like, I mean, I'm done. I don't need him anymore.
And if that wasn't recorded on audio, I mean, I only heard it on.
Oh, I don't even mean that. I just mean his performance in that movie. You know, I could give a shit about Good for You and McGee, all that.
I mean, that stuff alone, on Stern, they play it still, where it's just like, he's in my sight line, Good for You, McGee. I mean, first of all, a person seriously saying the word McGee and meaning it is just like cartoonish to me. Like, there's a person, a director, the guy that made Charlie's Angels is making the shitty Terminator Salvation. But so you have to make the separation, right? So in 2000, Christian Bale, post Newsies, does this performance. And I don't think it's one note, but I'm not going to really push that because I do think that he shows a lot of range. I mean, it's all crazy.
Right.
But it's definitely like there's parts that are subdued. There's parts that are like he's hiding something. There's parts that are he's, you know.
Sure.
I like it a lot.
I did. And I remember, you know, obviously like you, I went on like the Wikipedia page or whatever today just to research a little bit. And I remember when the news came out that he sort of admitted that he based the performance in general on Tom Cruise, that he had seen Tom Cruise and just saw like no life behind his eyes.
Yeah, there was a Letterman interview and it was like this smiling and happy, but just dead eyes. And
right.
And
that's kind of what he was going for.
And if nothing else, it also seems to be damning as an actor who maybe might have to work with Tom Cruise in the future. Not to say they ever want to be friends, because if anything else, Christian Bale, the man, is a douchebag enough to not need these Hollywood friends or whatever. Right. So
it's a fascinating movie because it plays some very specific games and for the most part, I think is successful in that you're watching the movie and especially by the end, you're forced to sort of rethink things. But it plays fair if you go back and watch it again. That is it just presenting this guy who is a murderer, or is it presenting this guy who has these fantasies of murder? Right. And is it just a portrait of a guy who just feels completely cut off and alien, or is it an overall critique of sort of that Wall Street culture in the 80s?
Right.
That is sort of all these things at one time, and they're all kind of similar, you know?
Yeah.
But it can any of those readings, I think, would be correct, except for maybe that he's a guy who's actually killing people. I don't think that reading is correct, and I think it.
So you don't think he kills people?
I don't.
Okay.
I don't. But and maybe I'm wrong. But
I don't even know. Honestly, I came to this. I really like, and you know, I came willingly, not knowing or not having a decided opinion on that. Almost wanted to talk about that with you because.
Right.
I mean, it does. The movie is set up in such a way that for two thirds of it or three quarters of it, he's killing people. He's you know, murdering the bum. He's killing the girl, the prostitute, the two prostitutes. And then at the end, it's kind of like this. In a lot of other movies, when there's a twist like that, where it's kind of unfair. It feels disingenuous. It feels like you've been cheated. And this one, it doesn't. It makes you reexamine things because if nothing else, it's a subject. When you're examining a crazy person who, you know, he's crazy either way. If it kills people, he's crazy. Even if he doesn't kill people, he's still crazy. When you do that twist, it's a little more believable. I guess it's a little more, you know, acceptable.
And, you know, the sort of the big thing that the movie hangs on is the reveal is he kills Paul Young, played by Jared Leto, whatever. Paul Allen. Who did I say?
Paul Young.
Paul Young is a singer. He doesn't kill that guy. That guy sings Every Time You Go Away.
Every time you go.
Murder! So he kills Paul Allen. And late in the movie, he's talking to a guy who says, no, I just had lunch with Paul Allen or whatever.
I just saw him in London,
And so on the one hand, you're like, oh, well, Paul Allen is still alive. So he obviously didn't murder him. But I guess to your point, like I said, the movie does play fair because throughout the movie, everyone is getting no one knows who anyone else is.
Right.
They're getting names wrong all the time.
That's a running
theme, all we know.
Which speaks to what you said before about how it's a commentary on the shallowness and emptiness in this like Wall Street world from 19, I think the book's from 89, but the movie takes place in 87, which is even more ingrained in the Reagan era Wall Street, you know, mythology. And everyone gets everyone's name wrong. And that's even how Patrick Bateman goes out with Paul Allen. Because Paul Allen thinks he's this guy named Marcus.
Right.
And
nobody likes Patrick Bateman.
Right. Which is very funny.
Right. Including Patrick Bateman, you know? And it's like, there's all these things where, like, he'll be out with people and he'll basically confess that I'm in murders and executions is the one, you know, that's like kind of famous. And the girl hears I'm in mergers and acquisitions. And it's just like, okay, so is he a crazy guy who is only sort of hallucinating that he just said that? Or is it this critique of the fact that nobody listens to anyone?
Well, that's
and
the
it's
whole,
all just white noise.
The confession to his lawyer.
Right.
Where he reveals everything. And I read too that all of his admissions were from the book, even though, like, we don't see that stuff on film. All the people he supposedly killed, you know, he said between 15 and 20 people. It's from the book. But so when he finally confronts the lawyer, who's also the same person that said he saw Paul Allen in London, he's like, oh, that was hilarious.
Right.
And he also gets his name wrong again. So it's like a combination of, like, I don't believe you. We're so jaded. Who knows? We're all coked up, you know,
right,
too.
Right.
And we don't, we're all interchangeable with our Rolexes and our Cartier and all that stuff.
For me, the movie always kind of goes off the rails, and not in a good way. Even rewatching it again for this podcast, I had the exact same reaction to it that I had like in 2000 when we saw it. The movie works really, really well, I think, up until he kills the hooker and Gwen Turner with the chainsaw or whatever. Everything after that, to me, kind of doesn't work. And that's sort of where it gets really ambiguous, a lot of that stuff. There's a sequence that where he's at an ATM, and it's very funny. Then he sees a little stray cat, and the ATM says, like, feed me a stray cat. So he starts to try and put it in the ATM. And a woman comes up and says, what are you doing? And he shoots her. And then he goes on this, it goes crazy. But to me, that sequence,
it goes off the rails? Because I think that sequence is great.
Here's my problem, and this is probably just personal to me. It's like, it's too crazy for the logic of the movie thus far.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, I don't think it goes far enough to accomplish what it wants to accomplish. And maybe that's just
fantastical. Like, it's not too. It's,
I mean, by the time we get to the cop cars, like, exploding in right. balls of flame, like, it's definitely gone far. I think it needs to go even farther to really. Because to me, that's the point where it says this is fantasy.
How would it go farther? I mean,
I don't know. I don't know. But I wanted it to keep sort of topping itself.
I just liked in that sequence. I mean, it accomplishes a couple things. He kills a few people,
right?
Including the woman, a couple cops, a couple, like, doormen.
Yeah.
And one of them even gets his name wrong again. And it's funny, like, he passes a doorman who says the wrong name. He turns around as if he was pulling out a card or something and shoots him. And it's, like, it's done for a laugh, too, which I also find very interesting with this movie when you're laughing at the murders.
Yeah.
You know, when you find it comical that he's, you know, slaying these people. Like, you go back to the thing you just talked about, how he's with the prostitute and his friend. And he starts eating his friend, and the prostitute runs away.
She's the other screenwriter, Guinevere Turner.
Yeah. And she wrote Go Fish, yeah.
She shows up in some Kevin Smith stuff.
Yeah, in Chasing Amy specifically, right?
Yeah, and in Dogma.
You're playing the pronoun game.
In Dogma, she's next time I suggest you don't underestimate the drawing power of the Garden State or whatever, like when they're trying to buy bus tickets to Jersey, whatever. Guinevere Turner.
Very specific quote from
Dogma. Well, listen, I'm aware of Guinevere Turner from my obsession of, like, the Sundance movement in the 90s.
But speaking of Dogma, that was the other Lionsgate movie from that era that almost got an NC-17, because when American Psycho was NC-17, Mary Harron had to, you know, negotiate.
Cut out 18 seconds.
Right. And then Dogma also was NC-17 for blasphemy.
Oh, jeez. I didn't know you could get, I mean,
whatever. It's so arbitrary.
Right?
And qualitative.
Like, who is it blasphemous to?
I don't, buddy,
you know?
Jesus.
That's crazy. There's more than one religion.
But I
just
scene,
kidding. There's only one.
And they're all cults. The scene where he kills the prostitute with the chainsaw. I mean, that's such a great, he's running after her. He's got his shoes on. He's running after her down this hallway with the chainsaw.
But he has the slippers on, and it's like such a funny image. He's naked, bloody, with a chainsaw.
I think he's wearing
shoes.
Yeah. And he, like, follows her. She's running down. He drops the chainsaw, and he screams. And I just love, it cuts to him at dinner with his fiancée, played by the lovely Reese Witherspoon. I'm just kidding. No, she's fine. Actually, she's great in this. This is her era, like, election era.
Yeah, this is where, this is right after
American Psycho.
This is where it goes away.
And he's drawing with crayons on the placemat the murder, like a chainsaw in the back of a girl and just red blood everywhere. I'm just like, man, this movie. And I'm laughing at this like poor girl that was just murdered.
Because it is a horror movie, lest you think we shouldn't be talking about it during Scary Movie Month. But it's much more of a black comedy than it is a straightforward horror
I was reading
movie.
Some like description. It was like psycho thriller black comedy with elements of slasher horror. I'm just, you know, whatever. It's just, it's kind of uncategorizable. Whoa. In that respect. But it definitely has all those elements. I mean, there's parts that are very funny, like the opening scene, which is also famous, where he does his daily routine, his regimen, where he does the mask and the workouts and all this stuff. And he's working out to Texas Chainsaw Massacre playing on the TV behind him. And I think I find it funny, too, in the trailers, in the commercials for the movie, they show a scene where he's pulling a face peel off his face.
Yeah.
And in the movie, it's just him doing his face peel. But it definitely adds such a creepy element that you don't know what he's Ed Gein wearing a woman's skin.
Yeah. Your mind immediately goes to like Silence of the Lambs. Right. And just like, oh, yikes, that's a disturbing image. But
right. But I do like all the beats of the movie. Like, I mean, it's all empty. They never show him working except he's unimaginably wealthy.
Everyone is a vice president.
Right. Everyone's a vice president. There's a whole scene with the business cards, which is also really famous.
That's a scene that, stands out in my head.
And it's hilarious because it's like, it's bone with raised. I mean, it's all these descriptions for white. It's eggshell. It's off-white. It's bone. And then the scene, he's so angry when one of the guys shows his cards in a later scene that he goes to murder him. And the guy interprets that as a sexual advance and kisses his hand. And it's just like, it's
Matt Ross.
It is unbelievable. So,
Albie from Big Love.
I'm being a little love fest with this movie right now, but I honestly, all the beats do work for me. And there is an element at the end where I don't know necessarily what's what, you know?
I definitely kind of read it as the hallucinations of a crazy person. Like I said, I mean, to an extent it does play fair, I guess. And
is there
could
an answer?
Be read.
Is there like a definitive?
No, I don't think so. No.
Okay. I just was curious if we're just being like, I think it's this. And then someone writes back and says, you guys are assholes. You
know,
it's this.
To me, I mean, Mary Harron made the movie, so that it's a fantasy, you know,
yeah.
But that she has not said that necessarily to my knowledge. It's just the way that the whole movie is sort of pitched that leads me to believe that we're not supposed to take this all at face value.
Okay.
And it's fascinating, too, that the movie is written by two women.
Yeah.
Directed by a woman.
What else has Mary Harron done? She does a lot of interesting, like, you would think that I hate to sound misogynistic, but you'd think that the stuff that she does is very masculine in a way, or very...
Well, the only other movie I can think of right now is I Shot Andy Warhol, which was sort of her breakthrough. I'm sure she's directed since then, but I don't know what off the top of my head.
Okay.
Bret Easton Ellis, you know, is sort of famously criticized for being a misogynist, in particular with American Psycho. And so I think it was a smart move for a woman to try and tackle it. I don't think that the movie comes off as misogynistic, mostly because I think it is such a critique of sort of that 80s era alpha male. That's, just that scene with the business cards is such a funny, like, mocking of a dick measuring contest, you know, in a really smart way.
I just did my research. She directed the most recent thing she did was The Notorious Betty Page.
Oh, okay.
And again,
I saw that. Gwen Turner shows up in that too. I think she's like a dominatrix.
My point simply is, it's just interesting. You wouldn't think that a woman directed, that's all I'm saying. And it comes across as incredibly ignorant and incredibly narrow-minded of me to say that probably. Because, again, I don't want to sound like a misogynist, but if you watch American Psycho, it's like male, male, male. But you're right. It's a critique on that, and it's smart.
Yeah.
And I've actually only seen a couple scenes from Betty Page, and I don't mean that as a joke, although I have seen a couple scenes from Betty Page, if you catch my drift. But it was actually on TV the other day, and I watched half an hour of it. And I was just kind of bored by it. But
by the way, Gwen Turner does not play a dominatrix in The Notorious Betty Page. I got that confused with like one of those IFC like indie sex specials. She shows up in something as like a dominatrix. It's not The Notorious Betty Page.
But that is Gretchen Mol, right?
That is Gretchen Mol, yes.
I also like some of the supporting performances in American Psycho are phenomenal.
Almost everybody is somebody.
Right.
And I don't think that was the case in 2000. I mean, some of us knew who Chloe Sevigny was.
Right.
We'd seen Kids.
We just were waiting. We're crossing our fingers, waiting for her to give that on-screen blowjob that we know like, she's going to do.
Justin Theroux wasn't necessarily anybody yet.
Is he anyone now except for Jennifer Aniston's boy toy?
He wrote Tropic Thunder. I know. He wrote Iron Man 2.
Well, no, you're right. Josh Lucas wasn't really anyone.
Right. He was not yet the next Matthew McConaughey.
I think Jared Leto was somebody.
Yeah, dude. He was Jordan Catalano.
But at the same time, now he's just the 30 Seconds to Mars joke. Right. I mean, even that like music
Reese Witherspoon
sucks.
Wasn't Reese Witherspoon yet. Right. Samantha Mathis, of course. Those
she
of us.
Was. Yeah.
Who know Pump Up the Volume.
And she definitely played the president's secretary in American President.
She definitely played that. She definitely did.
But one performance specifically that I love is Willem Dafoe, who is great in everything. He's, you know.
Listen to our Boondock Saints
podcast.
He's
the fucking man. He is so. He's so great, and he does lend an air of class and dignity and just like, I'm the big guns, and I'm going to perform the shit out of this stuff. And I found out that Mary Harron gave him some direction, specifically the first scene, or I don't know if it's the first scene or the second scene, but where he's interrogating Patrick Bateman in Patrick Bateman's office.
Yeah.
The director gave him direction to, I guess she took three takes. And one take was, you know that he did it. And one take was, you don't know that he did it. And the third take was, you don't think he did it. And he did all these very, just, again, because Willem Dafoe is the man, he did right. subtle variations.
Right.
But then when they cut it all together, they chose from all different kinds. So as an audience member, we're, like, as confused as Patrick Bateman was, which is just like, I mean, that's really a clever little trick, you know, and I think it's right. great. Which also a testament to how great he is as an actor, too.
And I guess, you know, I had said that I feel like Mary Harron directs so that we make our minds up, but maybe, you know, she's going out of her way to make sure that we don't, that all these different things are possible.
And that could be deliberate too. It could be both, yeah. You know, I mean, obviously I think even us talking about it right now, 11 years after it came out is still a testament to like, well, what is this then?
But let me ask you this, does having it, and I know the ambiguity is present in the book. That's how the book ends that we don't know
right.
if it's real or fiction. Does it make it better?
Does not knowing make it better?
Yeah.
I think so.
How, in what way?
That's the end of my thought. What do you think, Patrick?
don't know that it does.
I think that I like... Well, let me say this. I think if I were to watch this... Okay, this is going to sound so qualified and dumb and subjective. But if I watched the movie once at age 21 years old, 22. If I see this movie once at 22 and it's this uncertainty, I'm definitely intrigued and I want to watch it again. If I never do... So be it. But now that I've seen it four or five times, I do like that I'm still thinking about it. I still, unlike something that's just cut and dry, and it's, he definitely didn't do it, it sticks with me a little more in that respect.
But beyond, like, I mean, I can watch it and appreciate the way that the movie sort of walks that line and tries to, like I said, play fair, and achieves a lot of things tonally, which is, I think, what I appreciate more than anything, aside from Christian Bale's performance, watching it, what I really appreciate is the way that it manages this very tricky tone throughout the entire movie, that it's making very sick stuff very funny, you know.
Funny, or at least, yeah, just, you're yeah, absolutely.
But aside from appreciating that, the way that it sort of walks that line, I don't know that thematically, not knowing at the end, makes it any better.
Well, I could counter with, you know, we talked about Castaway before on the podcast, how, and I'm a fan of, like, the ambiguous ending. I've always liked it.
I am, too.
I like in Castaway for the audience, for F-heads out there, it ends in such a way. I know it's different. I'm not comparing, it's apples and oranges, but I just like how, spoilers for Castaway, Tom Hanks returns to the mainland.
We don't know if he's killed people or not.
Right. We don't know if he's the murderer. no, he sees a girl, and we want them to be together because she's single and he's single, and... He literally...
She has a job, though.
The movie ends at a crossroads. Like, literally, he's at the crossroads, and the movie ends. And a lot of people don't like that. And likewise, Sopranos, the series finale for Sopranos, I won't say too much, it's just ambiguous. It's just, what happens? People are pissed. I want a definite ending. And for me, I always like to think about things. I always like to sit and stew. I always like to imagine how, you know... And again, this is different, because it's not necessarily what's going to happen in the future. It's more about, like, what... The fuck did I just watch?
Exactly.
Where these That's are about the what's happening right. in the future.
Right. So. I'm all for an ambiguous ending, but this one, you know, again, calls the entire movie into question, and does that make it better? I don't know.
I don't either.
You know, is that what allows for all these different readings? I'm honestly trying to figure this out as we talk through it. Like, if we find out at the end that it's all a hallucination or a dream or whatever, can we still read the movie in all these different ways? I mean, I feel like we can. In fact, I think it lends sort of more credibility to sort of the deeper readings than if we find out, like, he's just an axe murderer. Because right. then, I know you don't watch the show Dexter. And I don't really watch the show Dexter. I watched the first two seasons of Dexter. People are constantly telling me, you gotta watch Dexter. You would love Dexter.
Right.
So I gave Dexter a shot. I watched two seasons. It's fine. Whatever. Nothing about the first two seasons made me think, I have to keep watching Dexter. But Dexter, I mean, owes an insane amount to American Psycho. But Dexter takes place in a universe where Patrick Bateman really did it. That's the premise of Dexter, that it's a guy who is so cut off and, like, alien to the rest of mankind. The only way that he's sort of able to truly express himself is through murder. And all the rest of the time, he's pretending. He's okay. just pretending to be a person, you know, which is what Patrick Bateman is doing. And to me, then, it's like, okay, that's fine, and he's an interesting character and whatever, but it doesn't allow for all this other stuff that we're talking about that American Psycho pulls off in terms of...
It's commentary. It's critique exactly, on society, right?
Right. Dexter doesn't have any of that, really. It's just a pretty straightforward narrative about, a fairly interesting main character.
Right.
But it doesn't allow for all this other stuff. So I'm just wondering...
See, now I'm wondering, is there... Now, I know we talked about this 15 minutes ago,
but... I'm wondering a lot on this podcast.
Is there...
I wonder...
Is there an answer? And I think for Bret Easton Ellis, I think he probably has an answer. I think you can't... I don't think you can't not have an answer if you're the author, the creator of this person, of this world, right. that you made this. What's the answer? Because I know some of his books, I don't know if all of them do, but I know Rules of Attraction... It stars
is garbage, by the way.
Well, the movie, I don't know if the book is, too.
Oh, yeah, the book's garbage.
The movie is just, I like one sequence from that movie. It's mm-hmm. the Europe, quick cut sequence. But that stars Sean Bateman as the younger brother of Patrick Bateman. I don't know right. if he does that, he has a mythology of his characters. But if that's the case, it lends some credence to, like, he has a mapped out world for these people, and there are hard yeses and hard noes, and that this world of ambiguity. And I think the movie kind of derivates from that, which is good, because again, for all the reasons we just said, that it takes place in the 80s, because it's so much to comment on. It says so much about society back then. It's just, I think it gets away with it.
Yeah. And I don't know how to come to terms with, like, the last 10 or 15 minutes of the movie, where, again, all that stuff sort of comes into focus, because...
Well, like Chloe Sevigny, the character that... Do you think yeah. that... If you subscribe to the belief that he is not a murderer,
right?
All the scenes with her, spoilers, she survives,
right?
Are all the scenes with her genuine? Like, he takes her back to his apartment after a great scene where he tries to get tickets or reservations to Dorcia and can't, but he lies to her and says, "Come to my apartment first, we'll have a drink." And he's rummaging through all of his murder tools and finally right. pulls a nail gun out, which is like such a great reveal, and points it right at the back of her head. And then later, cut 20 minutes forward, and she's flipping through his date book, and it's all of a sudden becoming the ramblings of his
right.
doodles
right.
of an insane person.
Right.
Is all that real?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, right. I think you can make a case that, like, well, I'm back and forth. I feel like, no, the nail gun isn't, but the doodles right. are, and it's like, well, that's not really fair. And as I was watching it today, again, I was watching it with this idea that, like... it's all made up. It's all fantasy. But then I felt like, as much as I said, the movie plays fair, you're pointing out some examples where maybe it doesn't, where it exists just to confuse you. And I think that's kind of bullshit. But the sequence where he kills the prostitute and Gwen Turner, suddenly the movie shifts. The whole movie is told very much from his perspective, and needs to be, because again, it's the story of this weird, unreliable narrator, like we said earlier. But when she begins to run away, it shifts to her perspective. And that, I think, is slightly dishonest also. Because now it's about, for those few minutes or seconds or whatever, it's about her trying to get away from this crazy guy. Whereas it needs to be
I don't know if that's the case. Does it shift away from her perspective? I mean, how does it shift away? I mean, I don't know if it's ever solely his perspective, the whole movie.
You don't think
there's
so?
There's a Chloe Sevigny, she's slipping through his date book.
Yeah, that's true.
When he picks her up, we're outside the limo, and she, he's pulling away, or, right. I don't know. I mean, I see that she pulls away, and we're with her escaping from him, as she's pounding on doors, which is, right. you know, like, again, does that happen? Because, again, that would be a pretty obvious
Which is thing. Why I'm saying, right, like, that is not fair if the movie is his fantasy. It's not fair that, because now it's suddenly about, we're in this movie that's about her trying to escape from this crazy guy, whereas it should be a movie about the crazy guy trying to chase down the girl who's getting right. away, you know what I mean?
Right, absolutely. And there are, you know, it's funny, in this, there's a couple scenes in this movie where it's so interesting. I always find it totally fascinating when movies accomplish this specific thing, when they accomplish getting the audience to side with the person who's wrong.
Right.
Meaning, like, I know, what's the movie with the guy trying to slip a...
Happiness.
Todd Solon... how do you say his name?
I don't know.
Todd Solon's Happiness. There's a sequence in Happiness where an older man who is a child molester sneaks a Rohypnol or something in this kid's Kool-Aid and...
It's a tuna fish sandwich.
Tuna fish sandwich. And the whole time we're waiting for the kid to eat it. And all of a sudden it's this weird transition. As an audience member, we're like, that guy is despicable. He is a child molester. He's a rapist or whatever he does. That's horrible. And we're on the side of this kid. But we're watching this kid not eat the sandwich. And we're like, finally, like, fucking eat the sandwich, kid. Like, what's your problem? And something JB points out in his Psycho write-up, he wrote about, we talked about our favorite moments in horror movies, and he talked about Psycho. And he didn't talk about this specifically, but it reminded me of the sequence where Norman Bates puts a body in the trunk of a car and puts the car in the lake. And for a split second, the car doesn't go down. And as an audience, we're like, holy shit, go down, car. Like, right, we're siding with right. whatever. And likewise, those are two very specific, obvious examples of that, what I'm talking about. In American Psycho, it does a little of that, too, where she can't escape. At least that's how it's like, right. No, this is his master plan. Like, we're somehow on the side of this sociopath.
Which, again, to me suggests that it should have been told from his point of view.
Yeah.
Whatever, you know.
Yeah, whatever. Whatever.
I started out saying like, oh yeah, it totally plays fair. And now I'm starting to feel like maybe it does.
Well, it does. I think maybe I'm switching sides a little too. It doesn't play fair at all, because the sequence where he goes to visit Paul Allen's apartment,
mm-hmm.
and it's apartment, I just said, by the way, and he goes there, it's totally clean. There's a realtor there. She's showing the place to these yuppies. And he looks in the closets where he is, like, it's been his, I assume his murder den, his safe house, where there's been corpses in closets and scrawled on the walls, die yuppie scum. I don't know why that's in there, aside to make a comment. You know, I don't know why he would put that there, but he goes there. Everything is cleaned up. I guess it's kind of fair in that it's either a fantasy or that they're covering up. They think Paul Allen did all the murders, and they're covering up for Paul Allen because he's missing or something. So they don't want to make a big scene. He's a very important white male in 80s Wall Street, you know, who, you know, isn't susceptible to the same laws that we are. I don't know. That's the way it doesn't really play fair. Like, what is right. this?
Well, see, to me, I just read that scene as like, no, he's been dreaming or fantasizing all
but
that other stuff.
I think there's a way you could look at it the way I just said. Maybe. Like, is Paul Allen the murderer? Did it get cleaned up? Is it just not on Patrick? And that's why even when the realtor shows up and says, why are you here?
Right.
She either knows that he's the murderer or she just thinks he's like interested in grisly murders. And she's like, get out of here because I'm trying to, you know, put food on my family.
I don't know. And the movie is a testament. So many movies we see now are ruined maybe by the fact that like the main character always has to be likable. And that's a critique that you hear a lot of times from people talking about movies, whether they be studio people or executives or even just critics who maybe don't know shit. That the main character isn't likable enough. I know that that's a studio note that a lot of screenwriters get. And here's a testament to, like, you can have a character, a main character, who is not necessarily likable, although Patrick Bateman is certainly charismatic. You know, he's obviously not likable. Right. He's not sympathetic. He's not all of these things that, like, a main character is traditionally.
Right.
But he's very compelling, and that's enough, you know?
Absolutely.
And like I said, he's absolutely charismatic, and so much of that goes back to Christian Bale's bizarre performance.
Oh, the way he... I mean, again, we didn't really talk about it, and it doesn't really... I think we don't need to talk about it, because literally what I would say is, like, isn't it great? It's the Chris Farley show, like...
Right.
When he's reciting all the Genesis, you know, he talks about Huey... I can't even say the word. Huey Lewis in the news,
Right.
And Genesis, and he's doing this, like,
he does Wikipedia. A rep of Whitney Houston, too.
Yeah, right. But he does, like, this, it's like an encyclopedia entry for each person. Like, you know, it's the facts about the whatever. So he does this rap on the three artists, and it's so funny, and it's just noise to, you know, like, before he kills somebody or, like, whatever. Doesn't really, but it's also, I guess, a, you know, unveiling of his personality.
Well, you get the impression that, like, he has rehearsed it, because in the absence of having sort of anything substantive in his soul, you know, he has to fill it up. He says very early on, I don't remember the context, but I remember noticing that line for the first time, that somebody says, like, why are you like this or whatever? And he says, because I want to fit in. And that is, I think, the most
They're telling... in the limo with, like, with his, with his fiance.
That's, I think, the most telling line in the entire movie is that he so desperately wants to fit in. And so he's rehearsed all this sort of trivia about bands, because isn't that what people talk about? And isn't that sort of small talk? And again, the performance is very over the top, and could... I can't imagine the ways that it could have gone so disastrously.
If it was Leonardo DiCaprio
or whoever.
Jonathan Scheck.
Was he one of the people?
I think so, yeah.
Really?
I think so.
Weird.
Yeah, for sure.
You just think about the way that Christian Bale over-articulates all of his lines, and the way he's so sort of weirdly robotic.
She's my cousin. She's from... I mean, that line...
He's like a conehead.
He absolutely is. There's a line I was watching with my wife, and she... actually posted this on Facebook, where there's, like, again, it's his crazy, narration dialogue over what?
It's narration over dialogue. It's very hard to understand.
I know, it's just noise.
A lot of people talking at once.
He talks about when they arrive at this boutique restaurant called Espace, and he starts this thing like, I'm in a near panic by the time we reach Espace, because I'm sure we won't get a good table.
Right.
And they do, and he's happy, and relief washes over him in a wave. And it's just like, I mean, obviously, it has to be verbatim from the book, but it's just, like, it's so telling of, like, he's got so much else on his mind. He wants to kill people. He hates his fiance. He's having an affair with Samantha Mathis.
Right.
But he wants the good table at the restaurant.
But that's the stuff that matters, you know? And
because
again,
he wants to fit in,
But even just in... That's the stuff that matters to all the characters, whether they want to fit in or not. Like, and again, that's...
We need a res. I'm not going anywhere without a res.
It's not, like, the most subtle of social satire, but, like... That's the shit that matters to everyone, and that's what allows him to get away with killing people and being a sociopath, because nobody notices.
And no one gives a shit because they're too focused on their res.
Exactly, and their business card.
Right.
Or what? Or they're, you know, drugged up like Samantha Mathis, you know, whatever. That scene with Reese Witherspoon where he kind of breaks it off with her, like, that's the closest that the movie comes to, like, an emotional moment. You know, and it's more she's just, like... bratty, like a spoiled kid who's not getting her way.
Right.
But, like, that's the closest to an honest social interaction in the entire movie, that he says, like, this isn't working out, I don't want to see you, and she kind of throws a fit.
Hmm.
More, again, out of, like, embarrassment, what am I supposed to do?
Or, like, how dare you? Like, do you know who I am?
Right.
You know?
So it's not, like...
again, she is shallow, too. And it's
so it's not that she's hurt or anything, but it's, like, it's the only scene in the movie, really, where two characters hear one another.
Yeah.
Like, she actually hears what he is saying and responds to it, as opposed to just everybody saying what they want to say and ignoring what the other person has just told them.
You know, the last thing I'll say about ambiguity is I think that this movie works. I think this movie has, it plays some tricks, and I think that sometimes it might be unfair, but I think the ambiguity works, especially works for me. You know, we talked before about student filmmakers. And a lot of times I think there's people out there that make movies, or even like lesser movies, where there is an ambiguity or things don't work. And their first response is, well, it's not supposed to work. And it's not supposed to be what you think it's supposed to be.
Right.
And I think...
Or just like I left it, the interpretation is open to the viewer. Like, well, that's a cop out.
It absolutely... Thank you. That's my point. I can't even say my point. But I think, you'll see so often with students or whatever that they're... making horrible decisions, and they don't have the skill set or the wherewithal to even put something together that works. I think Mary Harron, again, we kind of blew her earlier. It's ambiguous, and it works for me, again, despite that, I guess.
And it's not even like that I hate that about the movie. I'm not positive that it makes it a better movie. It's obviously truer to the book because the book is that way. And it's just those last couple minutes that for some reason, lose me, but I absolutely think that Mary Harron made the best possible version of this movie that I think could have been made.
Well, let's just agree to disagree. How many Fs would you give this?
Out of how many?
I don't know. I'm just trying to like invent a new
I'll
thing.
I'll say seven.
Seven Fs. Out of 20. That's very good, Patrick. We're trying to make this catch on. We have to bring a new gimmick to every podcast we do.
Absolutely.
So I loved it. I'm obviously like, I came twice in my pants, and thank you very much.
We hope that you are happy. Ben from Australia, hopefully we did a good job. With the movie. Hopefully Doug did a good job of offending your entire culture and country.
American Psycho is Australian for a movie.
There's an American Psycho 2. Have you ever seen it?
I have not, no.
Mila Kunis plays the psycho. And they kill off Patrick Bateman, not played by Christian Bale, just like, in a, I think he's wearing a mask, and like they kill him. Like, I don't understand that. Why you need to kill him off. Like, here's an example that isn't exactly the same, but when they made Triple X State of the Union, they had to, like, shoot this weird short film where, like, a Vin Diesel double is killed off. Because it's like, well, how would we accept Ice Cube as the new Triple X if we know Vin Diesel is still out there?
Vincent Diesel, please.
So they kill him off. It's like, no, it's okay. It's okay to have two.
Right.
So I think they could have had Mila Kunis be an American Psycho without killing Patrick
Bateman. No, I like it when...
Because then they could have made the third movie and they could have called it American Psychos.
I like when Roger Moore kills off Sean Connery.
Yeah, exactly, right. Or American Psycho Bandcamp they could have made.
The Naked Mile.
American Psycho Reunion coming next summer to theaters everywhere.
So you heard it here first, everyone. Seven Fs.
Douglas, take us out, please.
Don't just look at it. Eat it.